Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Katie Meyer in for Scott Lamar. This hour, we're going to talk about the growing movement within state government to change the way Pennsylvania's criminal justice system operates. Here to talk about that very large issue are two lawmakers who have spent a lot of time on it, Representative Jordan Harris and Senator Anthony Williams. Both of them serve as the Democratic whips for their chambers. And we also are going to have two people with some firsthand experience in both state government and state prison. Joining us at the start is former House Speaker Bill DeWeese and Pardons Board Secretary Brandon Flood will also be with us in a little bit. Welcome, all of you. A little bit of a big panel today.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Yeah.
Good morning. So we welcome your questions and comments. Smart Talk listeners, call us at 1-800-729-7532, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter, or at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. So first off the bat, I want to talk about just the overall prognosis for criminal justice legislation in Harrisburg lately. So I'll note all of you guys are Democrats. That's on purpose. Democrats have been on this issue for a while, but and you have a broad range of bills that you've been backing, your caucuses have been backing. But it should be said there's bipartisan support for a lot of this. And so just to contextualize where this has been, I want to start off with the clean slate legislation that passed last session. Senator Williams, Representative Harris, both of you backed that. How did it get consensus support? How did it become law? Senator Williams, I'll start with you.
So, ironically, with me, and it may be a little bit different with Representative Harris, national organizations came to Pennsylvania, and they reached out to Senator Wagner, and then were, I don't know, both of us.
Yeah.
And asked whether we would be interested in supporting legislation that would allow for one's record to be expunged without going to court. And obviously, for me, it represents a significant portion of the people I represent. And then increasingly across this nation, the costs, et cetera, and a variety of other things have attracted other people. The organization I was initially contacted with was one that, frankly, I was very skeptical of. Republican-leaning. I wouldn't say conservative, but close, not moderate.
Sure.
And so I was confused by their even conversation. And frankly, the more I talked to them, the more that I realized they were very genuine. That started it for me, at least in Pennsylvania. And then, of course, other groups in Pennsylvania sort of jumped on board. And from that, we had the opportunity to introduce the bill together, which was, if you call an odd couple,
that was more
an outrageous couple.
Right, yeah, so Senator Wagner, he was the Republican. He's no longer in the Senate, but he ran for governor against Governor Tom Wolf, seen as a very conservative person. And yet he was on this bill right from the get-go. And so just to clarify, you said it expunges someone's record. This is for nonviolent misdemeanors and summary offenses, and it's after 10 years with no reoffense, right?
Correct.
And then right now it is partially in effect. You can apply to get your record expunged, but it's going to be automatic for those people who qualify starting in, I want to say, June?
Actually, Representative Harris probably would tell you more because his bill actually passed.
So the House version of this bill is the one that passed.
Yes. So this started for me back in 2013 when I got elected. One of the first pieces of legislation that I introduced was around criminal record expungement and sealing. It didn't happen in 2013, but in 2016, working with Republican Senator Stuart Greenleaf, we amended legislation we amended a Senate bill in the House that Senator Greenleaf had authored, and that started us on the pathway to be ready to do clean slate because we created what's called an order of limited access. So in some states you have expungement. In Pennsylvania we have limited access, which means that your record is sealed in the sense that when you apply for a job, an employer can't see it, but law enforcement still have access to it, right? So we created the Order of Limited Access in 16, in Act Number 5, and then in 18, it was actually Sharon Dietrich, who works for Community Legal Services in Philadelphia. Clean Slate was actually her brainchild, and then Justice Action Network, ACLU, Commonwealth Foundation, Americans for Prosperity, and all of the other, and the chamber, all of the other advocacy groups begin to come on board and say, look, this is something that we need to do. And my partner in the House, you know, for us, it is an odd couple. I'm an African-American Democrat from urban South Philadelphia, and Cheryl Delosier, who's become a friend of mine, is a white Republican woman from Cumberland County.
Right.
I mean, you would never think that we would be able to work together and see eye to eye. And the truth is, not only have we worked together on this legislation, we're working together on more legislation, and we've been actually going to different places across the country to talk about criminal justice reform together.
Mm-hmm. And that was really why I wanted to start off with that clean slate success that you guys saw, because there was this really, to me it was unexpected, but bipartisan push to get this thing done. And you started seeing this common ground. A lot of Republicans have an interest in getting people back into the workforce, doing things that'll strengthen the economy, making, you know, the criminal justice system, frankly, cheaper. And you folks wanted to get people out of prison, back into the workforce, cut down on recidivism. So there is that common interest. And now, Bill DeWeese, over there with you, I want to check in because you were in the legislature quite a while ago. Then you did go to prison, and you've been around, though, lately, and you've been advocating for some criminal justice reform issues. I want to ask, I mean, back when you were in the legislature, you were House Speaker, what was the feeling on this sort of issue?
It was completely the opposite.
Yeah.
The idea of lock them up and throw away the key was preeminent. Mm. And the fact that I voted with Tony Williams over the years was well known when I was incarcerated. And for the 23 months I was upstate, I got along very well. One of the reasons was my voting record had been very progressive, but we had been in a vast minority. Some of those mandatory sentencing guidelines were hurled into the Senate from the House with votes of 175 to 25. Mm. So it was exactly the opposite. But the great 19th century French literateur Victor Hugo said once, and it deals with today, nothing is so powerful as an idea whose time has come.
Okay.
And when Jordan Harris arrived on the scene, the time had come.
Oh, really? Well, and so that is interesting. And so now we have seen, and you guys mentioned this, you know, growing sense of bipartisanship on this issue. So right now, this session, I'll give it to either Representative Harris or Senator Williams. What are the top of line issues?
So I mean, Tony and I both have probation and parole reform bills that we're looking to work on to get through either chamber and into the governor's desk. And simply put, when you look at the parole and probation system in PA, back in 2016, we had about 112,000 people on some type of probation and parole. And the issue with the system is there are a myriad of things that can end you back up in prison called technical violations. The thing that's always crazy to me is the term is technical violation. Like, just using the word technical means, you know, that we have a problem here, you know.
Well, and so what could a technical violation be?
Any type of interaction with the police. So you're standing on a corner, two people get into a fight, you break up the fight, police come to the scene, they take everybody down to the police station. They say that you didn't do anything, that they let you go, but that's still a technical violation. A judge could put you back in jail for something like that. I mean, there have been egregious cases where people have gotten pulled over for traffic violations, and it's ended them back in prison. So, you know, those kind of things. And then the nature by which you can be on what I call a perpetual state of probation. A judge can resentence you at any of those hearings to an extended period of time. And it's just not right. It doesn't make sense. And honestly, beyond that, the data shows that it doesn't make sense. After about 3 years, we know if you've made it to that point that a person's not going to recidivate. So Tony and I, both in each of our chambers, are working together. And we both have Republican co-sponsors who we're working with to try to get this bill to the governor's desk. And I honestly think that there is agreement. I mean, even the DA's Association has come out and said that we have far too many people on probation here in Pennsylvania, and they would like to see changes as well.
Real quick, and we're going to get a little bit more into this, but I do want to take a call. This is from Heather in Mechanicsburg.
Hi.
Hi.
One thing, I'm a small business owner, and I hire from a lot of the halfway houses, try to give guys skills to go out and get work at their in their hometowns when they leave the halfway house. I also had two brothers that have been in local, county, state, and federal prison. The one thing that, and I love everything you're doing, the one thing barrier I see for prisoners coming out into the workforce is they come out with no Social Security card, no birth certificate, no Pennsylvania ID. And if they are eligible for a license to get their license back, they their licenses were never turned into PennDOT, so they have to start the clock on that. You can't get a job without a Social Security card, a birth certificate, a Pennsylvania ID. A lot of these prisoners are let out of prison with a one-way bus ticket and maybe $5. That happened to my brother and his prison clothes, which was awesome. So to get your birth certificate, you need $20, and you need an address. To get your Social Security card, you need an address. To get a Pennsylvania ID, you need $32.50. And an address and your birth certificate and a Social Security card. It's a vicious circle, and no prisoner should be allowed out into the workforce to try to get a job with. They should not be released without those three forms of ID. That's my opinion, and it's on us if they get locked back up, because if you only have $5 and you don't have those things, you're going to go back to jail.
Yeah, Heather, thank you so much for your call. And actually, I should note, we've been joined by Brandon Flood. He's the Pardon Secretary for Pennsylvania. And I think you're pretty well equipped to answer this. So what are your thoughts on Heather's point here?
Yeah, it's been my understanding and, directly experience that the unit managers during the time, so following an individual going to see parole and putting in that home plan, they are supposed to coordinate with their unit manager and whoever they will be going home to, even if it is a halfway house. So I know over the last, I would say last 10 years, the practice has been at the very least to provide outgoing inmates with photo ID from PennDOT as well as working with the Bureau of Vital Statistics to get birth certificates or Social Security cards. So that is something that's done in conjunction with probation and parole, as well as that individual's unit manager. In terms of having maybe some money to go home with, I know that they put money in escrow, especially for, I believe it was Act 60, which is restitution for the Victims Act. So, I mean, certainly the inmate bears some responsibility by putting some money to the side, especially if they anticipate being released. But certainly I know that it has been a practice of the Department of Corrections to provide ID and any other credentials that someone needs. But, you know, maybe the unit manager maybe fell short in that. But that is the current practice.
Yeah. And I'll open that to any of you. I mean, have any of you heard of issues with this or had it come up in the state?
Well, yes. But I want to go back and give a context the issues that we're dealing with to start with. And the great thing about radio is I can read my notes and no one can see it. So the populations in prisons nationally are declining. Mm. In Pennsylvania, we have the dubious distinction of being the number one state in America that we supervise more people than anyone else in America. Almost the population of Pittsburgh, 300,000 in Pittsburgh, 290-some thousand under supervision in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. There are a number of issues that relate to that. The condition is the way it is because of a few specific reasons that we are dealing with in this bill. Split time. So for those who don't know what split time is, you get a sentence from the state that can be combined with county probation periods of time. the issue of technical violation, which is really called administrative violations, falls significantly under the purview of the court. That means that you can walk in front of an officer, walk in front of a judge on any given day, your pants are too far down around your ankles, and they will tell you that's a technical violation. Further to that, the conversations within those courts are frankly, and it was described by someone who's currently in this situation, a rope burning at both ends. So you're required as a condition of your parole to get a job, but the conditions of your parole say you cannot be out after X hour. Mm-hmm. So you get a job at a fast food restaurant that's after 10 o'clock at night. Guess what? You can't have the job. Guess what? You've committed a technical violation because you can't get a job. Mm-hmm. You're late to court. That's a technical violation. Further, these issues also relate to fees and fines, mm-hmm. and restitution. You can further be held on those issues. So, you know, our bills specifically talk about those conditions no longer exist. So we're asking the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing to create guidelines that are requiring the courts to follow these guidelines. One, at least in my bill, it talks about a cap period. So for misdemeanors, it's 3 years. For felonies, it's 5 years. Mm-hmm. You can no longer serve more than that, you know, in terms of your period under supervision. Frankly, the issue, and I guess it was heightened nationally when Meek Mills was discovered that he had a 4-year sentence and he's been under probation for mm-hmm. 10 years or something like that.
Meek Mills, for listeners who might not know, a rapper, very popular rapper.
Yeah, I'm glad you did that.
Yeah. Different audiences.
Yeah, exactly right. So, and frankly, the issue is not him. It's a problem across Pennsylvania. Sure. And that's the other interesting dynamic that, you know, initially when I went to the General Assembly, and I guess, then Representative Bill DeWeese would tell you, we actually had a special session mm-hmm. on sentencing.
Yeah.
All these issues were throw the book, the farther away that they are. One of the interesting personalities who's a part of the reform, who's now retired, is a state senator, Stuart Greenleaf, mm-hmm. Who was a part of the, as he would have described himself, throw the book away and put them in prison forever. Became a proponent before he retired as a member to support us moving this legislation forward. And wouldn't have happened if he hadn't become a very public person who explained why he reversed his position.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to note, actually, on your note about technical violations and outstanding fees and things like that, under the Clean Slate Bill, if you have these violations, if you have outstanding payments that haven't been made, you can't get your record expunged. So it does... get up there. We're going to go to a break right now, but we'll be back in a few seconds, and then we will get right back into this conversation. You're listening to Smart Talk. Welcome back. I'm Katie Meyer. And we're getting back into this conversation on criminal justice reform. Lot to talk about. I want to get over, Brandon Flood, you joined us a couple minutes late. You had some probation and parole business to take care of, and that's kind of what I want to talk about. You have a relatively unique, I think, perspective in state government. We alluded to this earlier, but you did spend time in prison before working in state government. And so I want to just have you quickly explain what your job is. What does the Board of Pardons do?
So I want to clarify one thing, because one of the biggest misconceptions about my appointment is that I am a voting member of the board. I am not a voting member of the board. I merely oversee the administration of the Board of Pardons, or the clemency process. I also help with the development of internal and external policy. But I do not have a vote. I merely can provide consultation to the board members. So I want to clarify that. And keeping in that same vein, the Board of Pardons is made up of 5 sitting members, one of which is the Lieutenant Governor, one is the Attorney General, one is a victim representative, one is a psychologist, and one is a criminologist. The process itself, essentially clemency, it's comprised of 2 parts, pardons as well as commutation. So pardons is for mostly folks that are non-incarcerated put in for pardons, which is to remove the existence of their criminal history. So anyone who's been convicted of any crime or anyone that's convicted of any crime beyond a summary conviction in Pennsylvania is not eligible for expungement. And then conversely, commutation is essentially the modification of one sentence. So someone that has an indeterminate sentence, such as life without parole, or someone that has a pretty large sentence, 100 to 200 years. There was recently a case where we did commute someone who was convicted of drug trafficking who was sentenced to 100 to 200 years. So, I oversee that process. We can delve a little bit deeper if you have any specific questions.
Well, sure. Yeah. And I think, border pardons, I think it gets attention when a big commutation happens.
Right.
But you guys are considering these lower level cases quite frequently. And just in terms of your goals for the board, I mean, you were appointed relatively recently. I think you're a different sort of secretary than we've seen before.
Right.
So one of the things you came in and you said you wanted to do was automatic expungements.
So that's one piece, but in terms of priority, I want to modernize our online filing and information exchange systems. You know, since the inception of the board in 1872, the formal inception, really from a technological standpoint. Granted, we have computers, but that's probably where the extent of our technology lies. So we haven't had an overhaul of our system. At some point, since I do have the legislators here, I do want to coordinate a tour. Use your sway with your majority counterparts.
We have swag, but not much sway.
I literally want to coordinate a tour.
That was actually good.
The lawmakers can come in and see how antiquated our systems are.
Sure.
Literally, there's hundreds of paper-based files on the shelves. So certainly there's a more efficient way to do this. Currently, the process from the time an individual's application is filed takes 2.5 years. There's no way that we aren't leveraging 21st century technology, and we can get that very easily down to less than a year. So there's enough. That would be priority number one, but also you talked about expungements, automatic expungements. What most people don't know about the pardon process is it is a two-part system. So merely receiving the pardon renders you eligible to receive expungement, which is a whole separate issue, comes with a whole separate set of costs as well.
Mm-hmm. And again, as I said, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman is the one who appointed you pretty recently. And one of the things he did off the bat about the pardons board, he can do some things unilaterally with this, was getting rid of some of the filing fees.
Right.
We've talked a lot when we discuss criminal justice reform about how to get people to reintegrate, how to make people productive and make sure they don't recidivize, go back to prison. And so for you, you're a person, you spent, I think it was a total of 8 years locked up in various capacities, and you were pretty young when this happened. So was this something that was on your radar, trying to, you know, how do you move past convictions? How do you get your record cleaned up, that kind of thing?
No, for anyone who's a returning citizen, you usually don't think of, certainly there's no dialogue or conversation about that when you meet with probation and parole, when you're released. Usually the first time you're thinking about that is when you're denied employment or you're denied some opportunity, especially if it's a repeated or if it's a recurring trend. For me, I really didn't have, luckily for me, I was able to navigate and do pretty well despite having that conviction. For me, it really wasn't because any barriers, but certainly, the main barrier for me, and as I had indicated on my application, and it's quite appropriate that I'm here with the lawmakers, is because I was constitutionally prohibited from running for public office.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that certainly working on other people's campaigns and just working in the political sphere, personally, it was something that, I would say, there's no reason why I should, if I can overcome this bar, why not? So, and at the behest of the former Secretary of the Board of Pardons, Mavis Nemo, I took her up on her challenge that I submit an application.
Uh-huh. And it worked out. Very good. Congrats on the job.
Thank you.
Getting into then just some other issues that are related to this. We talked about probation and parole. We talked about the fact that there is bipartisan support on this. So that's, for Representative Harris, Senator Williams, top of line for you guys right now. Are there any other things that you think, either it's a moonshot or that you would really like to get done, or that you think is, within reach in terms of, again, you mentioned you're in the minority, but,
As a person who's served a little bit of time, he might see it.
Bill DeWeese, you're pointing to, it wasn't you.
Because there's clearly things that we want to talk about.
Sure.
I'd like to hear his perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Bill,
go
ahead.
He was just sharing one with some of the ideas off the air.
Well, just quickly,
yeah.
And this deals with finances.
Mm.
And one of the reasons I think that the timing is so pertinent is because the Koch brothers and the NAACP, Newt Gingrich, and the ACLU have come together, and there are Republicans in the General Assembly who are alert to these motivations nationally. I will probably never say anything effusively complimentary about the national chief executive, but Mr. Trump did advocate on behalf of some people behind bars recently. So from the townships and the boroughs all the way to the White House, this subject is something that we're talking about. And thanks to Jordan and Cheryl and Art Haywood and Cameron Bartolotta and others, in both Tony was has been my friend for three decades, yeah, and his father before that. But I've been privileged to be in this town for 43 years, minus two, and this is the first time where it was so politically palpable that we could have some criminal justice reform for the aforementioned reasons. One thing for 30 seconds, and then I'll go back to team. But during the time I was there, the 23 months that I was there, we had probably 200 out of the 1,200, maybe 300, that were parole violators. And what did they do? In many cases, they had a cell phone under their mattress. They had a bottle of beer in their pocket. They were late for curfew. Now, again, these things should not necessarily be tolerated, but if you're doing 2.5 to 5 for a marijuana charge or some other charge, and you get out after 2.5, the Commonwealth was going to spend another $45,000 a year because some judge threw you back in that setting. So there's another $90,000 to $100,000 just for that cell phone under the mattress. Now, maybe you tack on 6 months, put them on an ankle bracelet for some additional time. But thank goodness there is a feeling in the General Assembly for reform, and obviously Governor Wolf and Lieutenant Governor Fetterman are at the tip of the spear on this issue.
And actually, Bill, I do want to follow up with you on that, because you mentioned some of the things that you saw inside, and I'm, you know, you being a lawmaker, you were in the General Assembly for many years. You got into prison in a different way that I think a lot of your, you know, fellow cellmates and other people who you were in there with did. You had campaign finance violations. But did you, were there things?
I pled not guilty, by the way.
I know
I'm still
you
under
did.
Appeal.
Let the record show Bill's still under appeal. But, you know, were there things that you saw that you would not have expected or that changed your mind about anything?
I've been privileged to be in Africa, in Uganda, Tanzania, Kenya. I've been privileged to see a lot of the world. But when I landed at Camp Hill, SCI Camp Hill, when I landed at SCI Retreat, and there were 1,200 men walking from the yard back to the cell blocks, it was an overwhelming cadre of African Americans and Hispanic youth. And I thought, with Michelle Alexander, the law professor at Ohio State University, and her wonderful narrative about mass incarceration in the United States, the new Jim Crow, I thought, when I get out of here, I'm going to do everything I can, and if I have my mom and dad's longevity, living into their middle, late 90s, I'm going to spend all my life advocating on behalf of people that really got a bad deal in life. And the prison situation, the prison system, is the epicenter of that bad deal. So my voting record was pretty good as a member of the General Assembly from rural Appalachian, Green, Fayette, and Washington County. But when I got there, I just could not imagine the number of men, because I was obviously in a male facility, men of color, African American and Hispanic. That was just a total surprise.
Yeah. And I do want to get into that a little bit more. We'll just put it into the third segment here. And for now, we can go to a break. But tune back in. And a reminder that we do welcome your questions and comments. After the break, call us at 1-800-729-7532. Or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Again, on the panel, we have Pardon Secretary Brendan Flood, Representative Jordan Harris, Senator Anthony Williams, and former House Speaker Bill DeWeese. And before we broke, we started talking about, you know, why certain people in great numbers get into prison, why others do not. And one of the things I do want to bring up is indigent defense, defense for the people who cannot afford their own lawyers. And Pennsylvania has the distinction of being the only state in the country that doesn't provide any state funding for indigent defense. It's left up to the counties. And there's really, there's not a lot of central, there's no central control over that. And WITF, we've done some reporting on this. this is an issue that's come up. Senator, you mentioned Stuart Greenleaf. He's now retired, but this was one of his issues that never really got anywhere, getting state funding for this. Where is it at right now, D.C.?
It's in a low because the bottom line is that the Commonwealth isn't doing well with their budgetary priorities currently.
And this would cost a lot of money.
It would cost a lot of money, but the reality is this. So providing indigent support, as we all know, it's kind of obvious what happens. You got O.J. Simpson with extraordinary lawyers who, you know, gets off free. And then you have other people who, you know, sell an ounce of crack and they get 20 years, right? And the basis of that is the fact that we have not supported them in a legitimate defense. And so the obvious, it's a cost to the Commonwealth. It's sending innocent people to prison, causing plea deals which occur. And so the judicial system that we are should be proud of is standing on its head. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that because we spend more money on prisons than we do on public education in Pennsylvania currently, we are in a, we're sort of in a catch-22. And so I would imagine after Jordan Harris gets his recreational marijuana bill, you know, passed, we will have additional revenue to support these kind of activities.
All right. Everybody has that revenue earmarked already.
Right.
It hasn't happened yet, guys. But then, Representative Harris, I want to bring it over to you because, you know, again, this is something people have talked about. How do you pay for something like this? Do you think, just apart from the question of where the money comes from, is there some will to look at how this works? Do people see? Because this isn't just you, Senator Williams, saying, you know, people aren't getting defense. We've done reporting on this. There was a study that the legislature did back, I think it was like 2011, that didn't really have a whole lot of an impact. And they've said, you know, there is just, there's vast disparities in how different counties facilitate indigent defense, defense for the poor. So is there recognition of that anywhere that you see?
Well, I think the first thing is, I go back to your question, you know, how do we afford it? I said, how do we not afford it? Because the truth of the matter is, you can't say a person is innocent until proven guilty if they're, if the shoe is on the other foot, where there's a preponderance that they're actually guilty before they go to court. And here's why. Here's how you figure that. In our system right now, I think it's like over 90% of our trials are plea deals. People aren't going to court. You know, Bill pled not guilty, but most people who aren't, you know, a speaker, right? 94%. They're going and they're taking a deal because somebody, some DA has, or ADA has walked in and said, this is what, you know, we have over you. We'll give you this if you take this deal. And most people, even the innocent ones, and that's the thing that people don't get. There are innocent people in Pennsylvania who do plead guilty, because if you're facing 20 years and they say we'll give you 2 years, people take 2 years because they can't afford a lawyer to help them fight their case. Mm-hmm. That happens every day. So when I say we can't afford not to do it, we're actually wasting money incarcerating people who either one didn't do it or two who aren't a threat to our society. So, you know, we have to find the resources, and like everything else, I mean, we don't have an endless pot of money. But for me, I think, yes, you know, I do support the full legalization of marijuana. You know, that is something I support. But I think there are other things that we can do as far as a Commonwealth to find resources to do all of these things that are necessary. And for me, this is definitely at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I think helps change this is the opioid crisis. Yeah. Let me say what I mean by that. If you're from Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, you kind of understand this, right? If you're, you know, a person of color, in my opinion, I think you understand this because, you know, in our communities, we see it every single day with people going back and forth and getting a public defender because they can't afford it. And let me be clear, there are lots of public defenders out there who are doing a yeoman's job of trying to represent clients. But when you have 30 clients in a day, it's hard to actually dedicate the time necessary. But because of the opioid crisis, we are seeing the criminal justice system permeate communities that have for far too often been able to ignore it because it wasn't at their doorstep. Mm. So now that it's at their doorstep, you have other legislators who now see themselves in the people who we're talking about, because it's either their son, their daughter, the kid up the block that they thought was a good kid, who now has an issue with opioids, who now finds himself entangled in the criminal justice system. So because of that, I think you see more legislators becoming more aware and in tune to this issue, but also to many of the other issues of the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. And there may have been, you know, years in the legislature, and I almost think this is happening quite recently, where it was seen as, you know, a Philadelphia issue, a Pittsburgh issue, an urban issue. That was a lot of the people who were going to prison.
Right. Yeah. And honestly, I don't say this because he's here, but I'm grateful to Speaker DeWeese and Speaker Prezel for
who both went to prison around the same time,
same cell for
right.
2 weeks.
Right. But here's why I say I'm grateful to them, because they helped put a different face on this issue. Hmm. And you know, Bill has been talking about this since he's been home, and I think it's important because you know there are certain people who see themselves in Bill that don't see themselves in me, right? And that's okay, because we're all from different places, different backgrounds, but because they see themselves in Bill, they're now more in tune and they're more open to listen to the conversation about what we're talking about with criminal justice reform.
Yeah, Bill, do you want to weigh in on any of that?
No, not much, except that the Pennsylvania Prison Society has also been reanimated in recent years, and Claire Schubik-Richards, our new executive director, is working with every organization in the state. That's just an additional layer of propulsion as this issue takes place. And lastly, the unions, the trade unions and the public unions are, and I think Brandon Flood can please piggyback on this, but they are so welcoming to many people that have been incarcerated. In fact, the national AFL-CIO has in their platform at their biannual conventions a platform plank that welcomes men and women who have served time and have paid their debt to society and are coming back. So I take my hat off to organized labor for that issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything on that?
Well, yeah, no. Shout out to SCIU, because they certainly did not ask about my criminal history either. That did not come up during the employment screening. But mm-hmm. No, to pivot back to what you were saying about indigent defense, what Representative Harris said was hit the nail on the head. You know, one of the other capacities that I serve in locally is as the legal redress chair for the Harrisburg NAACP. And I'm more recently is a case of a young lady who went to her school, her daughter's school, because her daughter was being bullied, constantly bullied. Daughter's 13 years of age. She just was fed up one day. She was waiting outside for her to come out, and she could see through the window that she was being taunted and that the faculty essentially allowed that to go unchecked. So she went in the building and took matters into her own hands. Certainly didn't assault anyone, but certainly was, you know, very irate about the issue. And they charged her with burglary, disorderly conduct, simple assault. So a whole slew of charges that once you read the narrative of what occurred, even the narrative doesn't match up with what the actual charges that were lodged against her. To Representative Harris's point, you know, she doesn't know anything about the legal system, is out of work currently, doesn't have the financial wherewithal to get an attorney. But, you know, at first blush, you know, I can look at it and say, this is no BS. You know, and granted, while I certainly do not have a law degree, you know, I will exercise my privilege with some of the relationships with the district attorney's office, as well as some of the magistrates, where, you know, certainly at the very most she should be charged with is disorderly conduct. But when you stack those charges and you have no knowledge of the legal system, and certainly you're deferring to whatever prosecutor or police officer who's telling you that you need to plead guilty, as Representative Harris said, although she is not guilty or culpable for certainly the offense of burglary during in the broad daylight while everyone's there, you have people that plea out when faced with the alternative being something more severe. So that's certainly something that needs to be addressed, and we talk about how do we fund that. You know, certainly at the end of the day, Bill mentioned the figure of $45,000. I know it varies between 40 $5,000 per year to house an inmate, particularly in Department of Corrections. You know, those savings can be, you know, you can reap those savings by not having folks enter those systems, not having to house them, even on a local county level. I know Dauphin County is about $90 a day. You know, so those cost savings are built in when you don't have people penetrate those systems to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And so we have those different areas to, you know, introduce legislation to look for issues. You have the front end, you know, indigent defense, defense for the poor, you know, getting people the information they might need to avoid long sentences. You have things during being in prison. We have had a bill that was being circulated right now to abolish the death penalty. That's a bipartisan bill. We have efforts to end life sentences without the possibility of parole. And then you have things on the other end. We talked about reentry. We talked about sort of, you know, getting people to the point where they don't reoffend, helping them with, you know, fines and fees and facilitating that. Are there bills that any of you have right now that you would want to draw attention to or that you think might have a chance of passing at any stage of that process?
Sure. So or quickly, one is around felonies. Mm. All of the stuff that we've done so far in the General Assembly has been around misdemeanors. I have a Republican co-sponsor who's willing to work on looking at how we expand our record sealing law to cover non-dangerous felonies. Mm. You have tons of people who have old drug charges. You have tons of people who have fraud, forgery, you know. Think about it this way. Retail theft, right, depending on the amount, retail theft can be a felony. But we haven't changed what the amount is in like 20 years. Mm-hmm. So you know, what it was back then and what it is now, it's ridiculous.
Inflation.
on what somebody could get, honestly, for a retail theft as a felony. And those felonies not only stop you from becoming gainfully employed, it stops you from getting public housing. Depending on the charge, it can stop you from getting money to go to school, right? So we have someone that we're working on with regards to expanding that to look at how we cover certain felonies. No, not murder, not rape, nothing against a child, mm-hmm. but there are non-dangerous felonies that we should be looking at. And there are a package of bills around the incarceration of women, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
A lot of times when we talk about criminal justice reform, we talk about men, mm-hmm. But the largest growing population of people being incarcerated are women, right? So there's a package of bills called Dignity with Incarceration that talks about women not being shackled when they're pregnant. That talks about providing feminine hygiene products to women in prison. It talks about free phone calls for women who are mothers to connect with their children. It's a multi bills in this package around dignity with incarceration, and I think people should definitely take time to look at on how we deal with women who many of them come home and within a day of coming home have to resume their responsibility as a custodial parent mm-hmm. For their children.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually. People might have noticed we have an all-male panel today, but there are a lot of women in the legislature who have worked on those specific issues, as well as others. I can think of, you know, Joanna McClinton, Katie Muth in the Senate, Summer Lee in the mm-hmm. House of Representatives. So that's something that is sort of a subsection of all of this that we should note. I have a caller, couldn't stay on the line, but Mike in Harrisburg has, I guess, a shout-out for Bill DeWeese over here. He says Mr. DeWeese is not a newcomer to the criticism of the criminal justice system. He understands what just us means. The prison system is made up of black and brown individuals. So I think someone who likes your comments there. Then getting forward, any other bills that you want to bring up? Yes, Senator Williams.
One's a bank shot and one is direct. So civil forfeiture.
Sure.
For those who know about it. So many people are charged with crimes, drug dealing, et cetera. They seize your asset, a car or a home. In Pennsylvania, and it's a national scandal across this country, but in Pennsylvania, they're allowed to keep your asset, even if you're not found guilty. In that process, then you have to fight to get it back. And so we have many underserved communities where people are frequently charged, especially if they do not have a lawyer, do not have the ability to get back what they've owned. For instance, a grandmother or a senior citizen owning a property. They live in that property their entire life. Their grandson or granddaughter is selling drugs. Police come in, bust. Do not formally find the young person guilty, but they've seized the property. And so that is something that we're working on the General Assembly today. The other part is drug addiction. So unfortunately, we have many, and literacy. So many folks in who are incarcerated are being released without the ability to provide for themselves, either being illiterate, continuing, or drug addicted. Mm-hmm. And while they're in prison, they do get some level of services. And so we are looking at a budgetary conversation with regard to that, because it obviously doesn't serve the public for you to get released and not be prepared to not only have a driver's license, but still be addicted to drugs and not be literate at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And budgetary conversations are always tough in Harrisburg. You mentioned that before. Do you think there's will to pay for something like that?
Well, I think, and the drug addiction area, absolutely, because okay. You know, the conversation around opioids, you know, it goes well beyond the prisoners, right?
Right.
And now that it's a larger problem in society, it can fall into that space that we can sort of navigate through and probably get something done.
Mm-hmm. And this could be a long conversation on its own, but the way you guys have framed this, the conversation has gotten larger with the opioid epidemic. There's a race component to that, isn't there?
There's a class component. Which always involves race and economics. The reality is, and I, you know, talking last night, we talked about the crack epidemic in America, which was never described as an epidemic. We could talk about the homicide epidemic by young people dying by illegal guns in America, and nobody's talking about it. So, yes, we have to take advantage when the larger community becomes unfortunately affected by the cancer, which starts usually in the underserved or black and brown communities, then we have a fuller conversation. And unfortunately, that's the way it is. I'm not here to complain about it, but I want to take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. We have someone on Twitter, Tamar Wallace, asks, can your guests speak to the costs associated with restitution and whether there's any effort to make that income-based? Restitution, Brandon Flood.
Yeah, so I'll fold in both of my responses. You asked about any bill. So
not
a bill in particular, but certainly the budget bill. You know, as I mentioned, we're looking to modernize our system, and we're looking to market, to rebrand clemency and market it as a tool and a viable option for those returning from prison or those that have been convicted of crime. So, you know, and one of the incentives for people who submit an application for clemency is to pay off fines and restitutions. That's one of the things that the board looks favorably at. Mm-hmm. If you satisfy those obligations, what better incentive to pay down those obligations than to potentially be able to be granted clemency? I know for me, you know, at one point in time, before I even put in, I owed $5,000. There really was no reason for me to pay the $5,000 in old court costs and fees. I wasn't under probation or supervision. But when I put in for clemency, I said, you know what? They're going wonder why that $5,000 hasn't been paid, and I paid that off within that first year. So that incentivized me to pay restitution. Furthermore, from a cost savings perspective, you know, I mentioned that, you know, certainly we're looking to ask for an increase in the 2019-20 budget to modernize our system and also to do some web-based develop some web-based tools and provide training and technical support to not only members of the legislature in their respective district offices, but for our local elected officials as well, too. Their offices, any offices that have a reentry-based component where we can help them, help us with those clemency applications. And at the end of the day, the stat, if you look, and this isn't subjective, this is on the Department of Corrections website. So 2016, 20,000 people were released from prison. The estimated recidivism rate is 60%. That means 12,000 within 3 years. That means 12,000 folks are going to be coming back. A lot of people are coming back because they don't see any hope. They don't see a true opportunity for a second chance. You know, if what we're asking for is a $512,000 appropriation for our systems. So even if we were only able to, out of that 12,000 people, positively influence them to look at clemency as an option, 60 people, you know, you would reap your benefits. That would pay for itself. Mm-hmm. 60 people out of 12,000 people over a 3-year period. So, you know, we're certainly looking to our legislators for that 2019-20 budgetary bill. But like I said, it certainly is. We're going to detail exactly where the cost savings lie. And then at the end of the day, it's supposed to be about restorative justice. So both I and the Lieutenant Governor want to live up to that principle.
We have just 2 minutes left. Anybody else have very brief comments on restitution or, you know, how to make that payable for people with, you know, little means?
Sure. 70% of people who owe are unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have to do is there has to be a process by which we don't hold them up from getting the record sealed or getting some type of employment. I think maybe you look at how do you put it on another docket to make it maybe something that's attached to credit and different things of that nature. And the reason why I say that, because if a person can't get their record sealed because they owe fines and fees, if they can't get their record sealed, they can't get employment. If they can't get employment, they can't pay it. So mm-hmm. at some point, we're going to have to deal with that.
We should do what we do with the rest of America. Make a part of America. A tax break.
Okay.
So if you don't have cash, if you're going to pay your restitutions, then you get a credit on the other end of it. So that those folks who fall on modest income levels do what everybody else in corporate America does. They get a tax break.
All right. Well, I think we're going to have to cut it off there. Thank you all so, so much for this conversation. And we will continue covering this issue on Smart Talk. Listen tomorrow for Scott. He's talking with two authors, Nicole Wisenzee-Egan, author of Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad, and Mark Bowden, author of The Last Stone. That is tomorrow. And I think that's it for today. All of you, thanks again. And thank you for listening. I'm Katie Meyer.